Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week.
Markets shrug off higher consumer prices. The economy is in the process of rebounding.
Will the Federal Reserve have its own digital currency?
The financial stories that shape our world.
Many people think the yields are just going to keep marching up.
We have more spending coming out of Congress.
One of the big questions, I think, on investors' minds, inflation.
Through the eyes of the most influential voices.
Larry Summers, the former Treasury Secretary.
Brian Moynihan of Bank of America.
Wells Fargo CEO Charlie Scharf.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin. From Bloomberg Radio.
Searching for direction in corporate earnings, in Ukraine, and in the economy. This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. Markets turned to earnings this week to find some relief from that bad January start, and it looked like tech might help us when Alphabet shot the lights out in growing ad search revenue at Google, something CFO Ruth Porat said was because of the strength of the overall economy and a shift to e-commerce. But then Meta came out with its earnings, sending its stock sharply downward, over 26%, on news of stalled Facebook user growth, which Mark Zuckerberg blamed on stiffer competition.
People have a lot of choices for how they want to spend their time, and apps like TikTok are growing very quickly. And this is why our focus on Reels is so important over the long term.
And at the end of the week, Amazon completed the tech whipsaw by posting strong cloud earnings and raising the price for Amazon Prime, which sent its stock sharply higher. And we didn't get any real break in geopolitics either, as President Biden and President Putin continue to talk past one another over the crisis in Ukraine.
But with Russia's continuing its buildup of its forces around Ukraine, we are ready no matter what happens.
We are analyzing written responses that U.S. and NATO received on January 26th. But it's already clear, I informed Mr. Prime Minister about it, that principal Russian concerns were ignored.
And if earnings and geopolitics weren't enough to confuse us, along came those U.S. jobs numbers on Friday, stunning the markets and economists alike with 467,000 new jobs in January. We expected only 125,000 and adding another 300,000 in revisions for December. Well, how do markets respond to so much confusion? They get volatile, with the S&P 500 moving up in the beginning of the week, dropping on Thursday into Friday, and then coming back to end the week up 1.5%. And the NASDAQ followed a similar pattern, but a bit more dramatically, shooting up only to plunge on Thursday and rising again on Friday to add 2.4% of the week. While in bonds, the 10-year yield seemed relatively tame, hovering around 1.8% for most of the week, but then shooting up to over 1.9 when those jobs numbers came in at the end of the week. To help us make sense of a difficult week in the markets, welcome now Sonal Desai, Franklin Templeton Fixed Income Chief Investment Officer, and Sharmeen Mosavar Rahmani. She's Chief Investment Officer for Goldman Sachs Consumer Wealth Management. So let me start with you, Sharmeen. You have your outlook for 2022 out. I have a picture right now, the cover. You have an icebreaker going through some really perilous waters here with a lot of icebergs. Tell us us what you're concerned about for U.S. equities going into 2022.
The key message is an icebreaker. It's a U.S. Coast Guard icebreaker that we've called USS Equities. And it's going through all these icebergs, hence the term piloting through. And our view is that U.S. equities are best positioned to pilot through all the risks. And the icebergs are labeled according to the risks we know are inevitable in a year like this. So the biggest iceberg out there is first inflation. Then the next iceberg is interest rate hikes. And much further out, we have the prospect that maybe we're going to have a recession. But there's some icebergs we've passed through, like Omicron and big energy prices. And so the recommendation to our clients is that stay invested. And we're calling it USS equities because we're emphasizing US equities. But let's recognize all the risks out there that we think will introduce a lot of volatility, as you said, but will not derail the economy or derail modestly positive returns in equities. We still recommend staying invested because we have about a 6% total return as our base case. So certainly a lot of volatility, certainly risks that we have to navigate, but something that we think is manageable for 2022.
So now to continue the analogy here for a moment, it did feel this week sometimes in the markets like it was an icebreaker zigzagging around some of these icebergs. And two of them, as we heard from Charmaine, were rate hikes and inflation. Tell us about those jobs numbers that came out, stunned a lot of people on Friday. Does that send a signal to the Fed, you got to raise your rates even faster and even more?
So, you know, those jobs numbers, we have to recognize that we have seasonal adjustment factors playing into these jobs numbers. So the jobs numbers, the participation rate numbers, actually, it's not very clear what they're telling you. You know, you talked a little bit about the revision, David, to December's numbers. There was also a revision to November's numbers, largest revisions on record. However, if you look at the year as a whole, some numbers were revised down. It's seasonal adjustment. So, you know, what you actually take away from that is a little hard to see. What I'm taking away from the entire report really is that 5.7% wage increase number. And then if you look at non-managerial, you're looking at 6.5. So you're looking at really strong wage growth. That's the number which I am focused on. And if I look further and think about inflation next week, I think that I would start getting worried if we got that upside surprise to what is broadly expected to be a 0.4-ish style increase, which will give you a headline of over 7%. But I'd say that's where my concerns would be about the Fed speeding up, but it would have to be in conjunction with that inflation number.
Charmaine, I don't know about you, but when I hear wage increases, I think two things. Number one, it's nice for the people getting paid more money. That's really good. On the other hand, it can do something to margins for corporations. Does it give you any pause at this point going into 2022 about earnings?
When we think about earnings, we believe that they have been the strongest driver of the returns since the global financial crisis, and they will also be the primary driver of returns in 2022. So our base case is about 12% growth in earnings, but we are assuming that we will see some reduction in margins.
Fascinating. Thank you so much, Sunal Desai and Charmaine Mosavar-Rahmani will be staying with us as we turn to geography and how the United States may be diverging from much of the rest of the world. That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk, then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Business Week, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
It wasn't just the U.S. markets that got some surprises this week. The European Central Bank didn't move, but Madame Lagarde sure made a turn in the direction of tightening. And the Bank of England moved up a full 50 basis points. Sharmeen Mostafa-Rahmani of Goldman Sachs and Sunal Desai of Franklin Templeton have remained with us to talk about what geography has to do with it, at least when it comes to investing these days. So, Sunal, let's start with you because, as I say, we saw more action on the central bank front in Bank of England and also ECB this week. It surprised, I think, some people at least. What did it do to the bond market?
Well, we finally saw bunds go positive, first time in 3 years, right? So it definitely had an impact. I would say that the Bank of England is the one which I find fascinating. Definitely, the ECB moves larger pools of money when you see a major central bank shift on a dime between December and now. December, probably no rate increases this year. Now, pretty clear we'll have a couple of rate increases, I'd say, later on this year. It's a big change. If you look at the Bank of England, and that was a truly hawkish turn, because not only are we talking, you know, in the US, there's still open questions, and the market fully believes that when the Fed reduces the size of its balance sheet, it won't actively be selling down the balance sheet, which would be big, big news for the US. The UK, the Bank of England has made actually said that they might do that. That's very hawkish and very unexpected. And I always look at the Bank of England because it's so interesting. They have the liberty to move because it's a smaller country, own currency. And I often look at them as a leading indicator of where potentially other major central banks could go. So something to keep an eye on. Markets potentially have room to be majorly surprised and loads of volatility.
Sharmeen, talk about the equity side, U.S. versus Europe, U.S. versus the rest of the world. How did it look in 2021? Is it going to look like that in 2022?
We have been much more bullish on U.S. equities and have recommended that our clients actually overweight U.S. equities in their portfolios relative to market cap. And just to give you a sense of the magnitude of the difference in terms of U.S. and other parts of the world, since the trough of the global financial crisis, U.S. equities have returned about 760%. And we'd like to use cumulative numbers because we think it is just such a huge number. It has more impact when people hear the cumulative numbers. Developed equities outside the U.S. returned around, let's say, 260%, so roughly 500% lower returns. Emerging markets, a little bit less than that. And China, just 220%. So U.S. has far out-earned and outpaced in terms of returns the rest of the world. And last year just was an incredible example of that. So last year, U.S. equities up just under 30%, let's say 29%. Non-U.S. developed equities are around 20, emerging markets flat, and China down 21%. While that kind of a difference can't persist forever, as they say, trees do not grow to the skies. However, we do think U.S. will continue to out-earn other parts of the world, other regions. And so even though they appear cheaper, we think some of that cheapness is just because of the sector exposure. The U.S. has a lot more earnings, for example, from technology and faster-growing sectors. They have less market cap weight in areas like energy and financials that are cheaper, while emerging markets and non-U.S. developed economies have more of that.
And so now what about on the bond side? Given what's going on right now, does it make any sense, for example, to be owning European bonds, particularly sovereign bonds right now?
I think, again, you've got to pick and choose. The one thing about Europe, which is true, is there are different countries in Europe, different underlying fundamentals, and there will always be parts of Europe which look attractive at different points in time. And I think that as you start seeing yields go up in Europe, conversely, one of the anchors which people expected would keep U.S. 10 years from going up too high, which is that as the differential with Europe, with the Eurozone kept increasing, you would see inflows into the US, and thus the long end would stay anchored. That argument starts becoming a bit weaker as you get some kind of normalization, and it's going to be much slower.
Charmaine, when you describe the really substantial difference between, for example, U.S. and Europe with respect to equities, I tend to think over the long term you can't have those kind of differentials. There's a sort of a law of osmosis in financial markets. Does that suggest maybe it's time to actually go into some of the markets, such as Europe, because they are undervalued?
That is actually one of the questions our clients ask us. So when you look at valuations across a series of metrics, U.S. Is trading at a much higher premium relative to, again, emerging markets and non-U.S. developed. And clients are asking, isn't this time to go, given that it's much cheaper than even average levels? But first of all, we do adjust for sector weights, and it doesn't look as cheap. And as we project forward, U.S. trend growth is actually higher than that of, let's say, the Eurozone or Japan. So you'd expect better earnings growth. The other two really interesting facts are U.S. labor is a much more productive labor force, and U.S. corporate management has much better management scores. So actually, they get better earnings out of similar levels of growth. And so our view is that the earnings gap will continue, but the outperformance will not be as significant.
So now we've had this whole discussion without once mentioning supply chains, which has been talked about an awful lot. Talk about supply chains, and do you see a differential potential between the United States and Europe or the United States and Asia with respect to relief of some of the clogging of the supply chains?
I'm not so sure we're going to see differences. On supply chains, I would actually say that one thing which has really kept me a little bit bemused is that when I look at the inflation expectations for most of this year, second half of the year, you typically see a very sharp decline in expectations of where inflation will go, partly related to the idea that, you know, you've got base effects which fall out, but then also with this idea that supply chains are going to clear up. And I really don't think supply chains follow calendar years, so I don't put much faith in that. The other thing I'd say is we haven't talked about this much, but and fortunately, it is only China, but China is committed to a zero COVID policy. Now, zero COVID is interesting because you can have completely very difficult to predict stops and starts to supply chains. And therefore, I remain a little bit skeptical about an easy, smooth unclogging of all the supply chains. That's one thing. Another point I would say, which is different to me between the US and certainly Europe, would be that in the U.S. you've got very, very strong demand.
No question. We've got no trouble with demand in the United States. It's the supply that's holding us back. Many thanks now to Sanal Desai of Franklin Templeton and to Charmaine Mosavar-Rahmani of Goldman Sachs. Coming up, if inflation is the question, can real estate be at least part of the answer? We get a read on the state of the market from Jeff Blau, CEO of Related Companies.
In our buildings, we're essentially full at rents, you know, even higher than pre-COVID.
This is Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
Fed Chair Jay Powell made it official last week. Dealing with inflation has become job one.
Inflation remains well above our longer run goal of 2%. Supply and demand imbalances related to the pandemic and the reopening of the economy have continued to contribute to elevated levels of inflation.
But as the Fed tries to get inflation under control, real estate may be pushing the other way. All of us, from New York City Mayor Adams on down, want to get people back into the office.
I need my companies back open and operating. You can't run a city like New York on 30%.
Even as the prices are going up for tenants.
Our data has a rent increase of almost 18% over the course of 2021.
But what may not be good for inflation or renters may work just fine for investors. Investors like John Gray of Blackstone.
The real estate market, for instance, because the fundamentals are very strong, particularly the sectors we're focused on, we're seeing pretty robust sales.
And of course, if it's inflation you're worried about, Mark Kissel of PIMCO reminds us that real estate is the tried and true hedge.
We like apartment REITs for a lot of reasons. It's not just the fact that they're real assets. The fact that they are an implicit inflation hedge for higher rents and higher wages is another reason.
And when it comes to real estate, particularly real estate in the New York area, there is no one who knows it better than Jeff Blau. He is the CEO of Related Companies. So, Jeff, thanks so much for joining us. Let's start with New York. Tell us what's going on with residential. What's going on with offices? We hear a lot of stories about dramatically increased prices.
New York is really, I would say, on a tremendous rebound post-COVID. You know, I would say everyone really thought we'd be fully back to the office, back to everything exciting in New York right after New Year's. With the variant, I think that got delayed a little bit, but it seems to be blowing its way through the city. And certainly I can tell you on the office side, our tenants are all planning for real return back to work, whatever that new definition is, sometime in the month of February. And I think that's very, very positive. We've got double digit increases of occupancy, people actually showing up to the office week over week. And so I think that's a very positive trend. In terms of the city overall, you've definitely seen people who had left during COVID come back. Apartment buildings that went down in terms of occupancy to 80% roughly are now back to 98-99%. In our buildings, we're essentially full at rents, even higher than pre-COVID. So that's been a tremendous bounce back because we were down to that roughly 80% number and concessions and so on. And so that's been a tremendous rebound. On the for sale condominium side, New York City had its best for sale year since 2007. So I think, again, showing that resilience of the market and back to the city. There was something like 17,000 apartments that traded hands last year. As I said, the biggest sales volume since 2007. So I think the city's feeling pretty vibrant, almost all parts of the city. If you try to go out to a restaurant, while again, there was a dip in January, it seems to me now things are busy again, the streets are busy, traffic's back. It feels good. I'd say the only areas that feel kind of quiet to me are really true commercial districts in Midtown a little bit. Here at Hudson Yards, it's very vibrant if you're outside, feels great. And so all the things that we love about New York seem to be kind of back in place, and I'm feeling good.
Jeff, on the commercial front, you say that you are getting back into full occupancy. Are you repurposing some of that? Because we certainly read stories about, particularly in the retail area, that there's not the same demand for space. Are you having to repurpose some of your commercial space?
Yeah, well, actually, we're repurposing, as you said. Retail has probably suffered the most of all the asset classes. At Hudson Yards, I think, we built a seven-level retail center that was anchored by Neiman Marcus. And when Neiman's filed bankruptcy, instead of trying to re-tenant that for retail, we decided to repurpose that to office. And so we are in the process of converting and creating about 400,000 feet of new office space at Hudson Yards to deal with the increased demand that we're seeing from actually mostly a lot of it from tenants that are in place today that are growing and expanding. And so while the office occupancy might be kind of in the mid-30s, or I think we hit 40% day in and day out today. Companies are thinking forward beyond kind of that full return to the office and making the decision to take even more space. And so we're feeling pretty optimistic about the office side. And like you said, I think there will be some conversions where possible away from uses that are not quite as valuable anymore, retail being the top one. There's been a lot of talk about converting hotels into residential or offices into different uses. I think it's pretty hard to do those conversions. I don't think there'll be too many of them. I think it's hard if you've got a building that's got tenants to vacate. So I think what we did at Hudson Yards was pretty unusual, and we took the opportunity to make that change. And that space is mostly leased already. So we're pretty positive about the office sector here.
Thank you so much to Jeff Blau. He is the CEO of Related Companies. Coming up, we wrap up the week with special contributor Larry Summers of Harvard. This is Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to London on April 25th for a solutions-driven look at the sustainable business and finance landscape, looking at the latest trends in ESG regulations, supply chain innovation and transition finance. Speakers include leaders from CDP, Emirates Environment Group, Seedtrace, COA and more. Summit advisors include City Commercial Bank, Red Sea Global and Schneider Electric. Visit BloombergLive.com/SBS2024 to learn more.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin, and we're going to wrap up this week once again with our very special contributor, Larry Summers of Harvard. So, Larry, one of the big surprises this week were those jobs numbers. The estimates were 125,000. It came out at 467. Also, there were over 300,000 jobs added for last month in a revision. So what does that tell us? Why are we so surprised by this?
A lot of it's special factors. They do a special year-end revision of the seasonal factors, David. I think the right takeaway from these numbers is that the economy is going strong. And I think the most significant number in it may have been the 0.7%, almost 9% annual rate increase in wages in the last month. It's hard to know exactly what to make of that, but it sure looks like we've now got wage inflation in the United States at really a rate that is very strong. And unfortunately, since labor is 75% of all costs, that suggests that apart from all the special factors, used cars, housing, and so forth, we're moving towards entrenching inflation at well above the target 2% rate.
Does this surprise upside and the jobs yield us one more piece of evidence that the Fed is behind with respect to monetary policy? And if so, is the message of the Fed from this quite possibly you got to move faster and bigger than perhaps even you thought?
There's no question with the benefit of hindsight that the Fed is behind the curve. I think it's important to say, respecting the Fed, that the errors of judgment they made last summer and last spring were quite widely shared in the economic forecasting community, but they were errors nonetheless. And I think the Fed's got to catch up now. And I rather doubt that bringing real interest rates up all the way to -2%, which is about what's factored in right now.
Well, let me just be specific with you. Over a month ago on this program, you said there should be 5 rate hikes in 2022. Should it be even higher than that?
Look, one of the very good things about Jay Powell's last press conference was he didn't say he was doing it, but he, in effect, ditched a lot of misguided framework that the Fed had talked about earlier, when he talked about being humble and nimble. And that's the way we've all got to be before the data. So I don't think there's any need to judge right now whether you need 5 or whether you need 7 rate increases this year. My best guess is that they're in the end going to need more than they now think. And that markets have to be prepared for a rate hike at every meeting, and they have to be prepared for the possibility that as the inflation process continues, we might need to have meetings with more than a single 25 basis point rate hike. But the data are very uncertain, and we've all got to recognize and be humble about that. So it's hard for me to know what will happen, but certainly anyone who's not prepared for a rate hike at every meeting as a real possibility, even with multiple rate hikes on occasion, I think is underestimating the range of possibility.
Larry, you would be the first one to say there's a risk in under-tightening, also a risk in over-tightening. Where is that balance in your mind right now? What is the bigger risk for us, over-tightening or under-tightening?
I think in an economy with 4% and declining unemployment rate, with a record level of job vacancies, and with wage inflation now on more and more measures above 6%, I think the greater risk is that we under-tighten and that we end up with an economy with underlying inflation above 4%. And then there's no alternative at some point to do the kind of thing that Paul Volcker had to do at the end of the 1970s. Now, we're not going to have double-digit inflation. We're not going to have 20% interest rates. We're not going to have a recession of that magnitude. But I think we are at risk of having something directionally the same. We've already put that risk into play with the delays that we have made. And the more we err on the side of letting inflation go and letting expectations rise, the more risk we take.
Laurie, one of the developments of this week was the beginning of the Olympics over in Beijing, the Winter Olympics. And we see there a different system from ours, both politically and economically, being put on display for the world. As we compete with China and other autocracies around the world, where are we in that competition? Are we as strong in our alternative, both in a political sense and economic term, as we were in the past?
I think we're going to endure and be strong. And I think there are important respects in which people are going to look back at the way China is viewed right now, and it's going to remind them of the way Japan was viewed in 1990, and it's going to remind them of the way Russia was viewed in 1960, that these things look like terrible threats, but ultimately our system endures. That's my best guess, and I'm not sure. But it does depend on our preserving the basis of our system. And what's new and profoundly troubling is doubts about the presidential succession process. And not so much that there are people who want to subvert the process, that's always been true. But good mainstream people who don't have the courage to do what they know is right and work against and bring down those who would subvert the integrity of our election process. And that's going to be a very important test for our democracy. And I might say to all those who listen to this show who are involved in markets that one of the reasons why the American stock market has been so strong is that people believe so strongly in the rule of law in the United States. And that's why the multiples on a given stock are much higher when it's an American company than when it's a Chinese company, frankly. And if our sense of the rule of law is called into question, that's going to have, in addition to everything else, long-term consequences for American asset values that we're not going to like. That's not the most important thing, but I think it's a significant thing and gives investors more interest than they may realize they have in these political debates.
And it is something we don't hear often enough. It's not just politics. Politics are important, but it's also the economy and our entire financial system as well. Thank you so much to Larry Summers of Harvard, our very special contributor here on Wall Street Week. Finally, one more thought. Spreading the wealth, even to the goat. It's that magical time of year on Global Wall Street, bonus time, with reports of pools going up 30, 40, even 50%. Level's Sri Natarajan of Bloomberg reports we haven't seen in a good long time.
Wall Street hasn't seen this level of excess in over 10 years now.
And it's hardly surprising. The banks did extremely well last year, and there's a lot of competition out there for that top talent, as Bank of America Chair and CEO Brian Moynihan recognizes.
You have to pay people. We don't want people who want to work for less next year.
As does UBS CEO Ralph Hamers.
We pay competitively, we pay for performance, we have the talent to make our plan, and to the extent we need to pay up, we will do so as we have done so last year.
But generally, you don't have to pay up for the top talents once they've walked out the door. And that takes us to the greatest of all time, the quarterback who's won the most Super Bowls by a lot. And by the way, has the most touchdown passes, the most completed passes, and the most games won, not to mention a few other records unlikely to be broken anytime soon, if ever. This week, Tom Brady made it official. He's retiring from the NFL after 22 incredible seasons, explaining to his 11 million Instagram followers that his teammates, coaches, fellow competitors, and fans deserve 100% of me. But right now, it's best I leave the field of play to the next generation of dedicated and committed athletes. His close friend and business partner in his fitness business, TB12, Alex Guerrero, told ABC's GMA that it's not just his family that Brady will be spending more time on.
I think he's excited about post-football career. You know, he's got amazing businesses that he's involved in. Certainly, you know, he has a passion for health and wellness and sharing, you know, the TB12 method and what we've been able to start there and share that with the masses. Like, he wants people to know how to be able to do what they love doing for longer and how to be able to do it regardless of age.
It didn't come as a big surprise. There had been reports of its coming for days. By the end, the biggest question was why he was dragging it out. So, why the wait? Speculation in the press focused on, you guessed it, his bonus. It turns out that his contract with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers specified this Friday as the day he would receive the remaining $15 million of his $20 million signing bonus. Some sports writers speculated that he might be waiting to make sure he got the cash. But at least this time, it was not the bonus talking, or even keeping Brady from talking. Under the terms of his deal, he was owed that bonus no matter what, although it was for a four-year deal that he'll complete only half of. So now it's up to the lawyers to figure out whether he owes some of that money back, and trust me, they will get paid no matter what. But however the money sorts out, a lot of fans are going to miss him.
He gave us so much pleasure around here, all that winning.
20 years here for us, 6 Super Bowl wins, you can't go wrong.
That does it for this episode of Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This is Bloomberg. See you next week.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.